Chapter 11. Revelations. The Noble Sport. Pacification 505. This was no place to be trapped. I dug into my reserves of concentration, and without any physical movement, struck him clean between the eyes. A psychic goad like that, especially at close range and with a clear line of sight, should have felled him like a force hammer. Cowitz didn't even blink. "Don't make me repeat myself," he said, raising the weapon so it pointed at my head. The room was psychically shielded. It had to be. Either that or something was leeching psychic energies out of the very air. "There's been a misunderstanding, Cowitz," I said. "I went for a walk and must have taken a wrong turn." It was pretty lame, but I wanted to keep his responses engaged and his mind busy.
"I don't think so," he hissed.
He was groping behind himself with his free hand, trying to find the control panel for the entrance. There was an alarm stud on it. I waited. At any second, he was going to glance round involuntarily to help his fumbling. When the gesture came, I threw myself forward and down, pulling my auto-pistol. He looked back with a cry and fired, but his aim was too high, and the shot flared off the end wall. From a prone stance, I punched two shots through his left collarbone and threw him back against a force door, which crackled at the impact. Cowitz collapsed face down on the floor, and blood began to pool around him. I reached the door control. An amber rune was flashing. The bastard had managed to press something. I hit the force door deactivator. Nothing. I punched Day Sumner into the keypad. Nothing. I realized I was in deep trouble. I guess the Cowitz had hit an alarm that locked everything out. That was what prevented me from opening the door. Uracel Glor and several of his house militia appeared outside the shimmering force door. I could see them peering in and shouting. I backed from the doorway and snatched up Cowitz's las pistol. When the door opened, I would use both guns to take down anything that tried to get in. Then, something psychic, dark, and monstrously powerful rushed into my mind from somewhere behind me, and I blacked out. A face was looking down at me as I came round, a handsome face with blank eyes. The face started to say something. Then it combusted and melted away, and I realized it was just a dream. And I awoke properly into a world that was nothing but pain. "Enough! Don't kill him," said a voice. Another voice laughed, and a tremor of acute agony peeled through my forebrain, lungs, and gut.
"Enough," I said. "Lock!"
A mild, disappointed curse. The agony receded, and I was left with numbness and throbbing background pain. I was spread-eagled, my wrists and ankles bitten by the manacles that locked me to a massive hardwood cross. They'd taken my equipment, harness, hood, earpiece, and everything else, except the leggings of my body glove and my boots. What could only be dried blood caked my lips, mouth, chin, and throat, and fresh blood still drooled from my nose. I opened my eyes. A meaty fist was holding my inquisitorial rosette in front of my face.
"Recognize this, Eisenhorn?"
I spat blood.
"Thought you'd wile your way in among us, and then produce this crest and make us all cower in fear?"
Uracel Glor took the rosette away and peered down into my face.
"Doesn't work that way with the House of Glor. We're not afraid of your kind."
"Then you are very foolish indeed," I said.
He slammed my head back into the cross with an open-palmed blow to my forehead.
"You think your friends are going to help you? We've rounded them all up. They're just down the cell block yonder."
"I'm perfectly serious," I said. "Others know I'm here. And you really don't want to be messing with a servant of the Inquisition, no matter how much at your mercy you think he is."
Glor hunched down in front of me, his hands steepled.
"Don't worry. I don't underestimate the Inquisition. I'm just not afraid of it. Now, there are some questions I'd like answers to."
He got up and moved back. I saw the filthy stone of the cell chamber we were in, a double-locked hatch up in one corner at the head of a flight of stone steps. Lord Oberon Glor and the obscura pipe-smoker from the library room stood at the foot of the steps, watching intently. The shipmaster, Gorgone Locke, sat astride a dirty wooden bench nearby. He wore some strange apparatus on his right hand, a glove of segmented metal that ended each digit with a needle-like spike.
"You've got it wrong, Glor. It's you who will provide the answers."
Uracel Glor nodded to Locke, who got up and moved towards me, flexing the needle glove.
"This is a Struci neural scourge. Our friend Mr. Locke is quite an expert in its application. We were delighted when he volunteered to run this interrogation.
Locke grabbed me by the throat with his bare hand, twisted my head up, and his gloved fist disappeared out of my field of view below. A second later, and cold lances of pain threaded my lungs and heart, and my windpipe went into spasm. I began to choke.
"Educated man like you knows all about pressure points," Locke said conversationally. "So do the Strucci. But they like to do more than tap them. They like to bun them out. I studied with one of their sacred torturers for a year or so. This grip, for example, the one that's choking you. It's also paralyzing your respiratory system and stopping your heart."
I could barely hear him. Blood was drumming in my ears, and explosive light and color patterns were fogging my vision. He withdrew his glove. The pain and choking stopped.
"Just like that, I can stop your heart, burst your brain, blind you. So play along."
With all the strength I could muster, I smiled and told him his sister had particularly commended my lovemaking skills over his. The glove gripped my face, and needles lanced into my cheeks. I blacked out again for a moment.
"Haven't killed him," I heard Locke hiss as consciousness swam back.
Dull pain oozed through my face.
"Look at him, look at him. Where's that cocksure smile now, you little bastard?"
I didn't answer. Locke leaned close, so his brow pressed against mine, and his eyes were all I could see.
"Needlework,"
he snarled, his foul, obscura-flavored breath swamping my gasping mouth.
"I just lanced a few points in your face. You'll never smile again."
I thought about telling him I didn't see a lot to smile about, but I didn't. Instead, I lunged forward and bit into his mouth. His scream, transmitted by our contact, shook my jaws. Blood spurted, fists struck repeatedly and desperately against my skull and neck. His long red hair came loose and the beaded ends whipped about my head. At last he tore away, roaring. I retched out a mouthful of blood and a good fleshy lump of his lower lip. His gloveless hand clamped around his torn mouth. Locke stumbled back, enraged, and then hurled himself at me. He kicked hard into my belly and hip and punched me in the cheek so forcefully it nearly snapped my spine apart. Then I felt the needle stab in between my ribs on my left side, and breathless agony enfolded me. Locke was screaming obscenities into my face. Once again, pain blacked me out. I came back in a rush of excruciating discomfort and gasping breath as Uracel wrenched Locke off me and threw him across the cell.
"I want him alive," Uracel bawled.
"Look what he did,"
Locke complained incoherently through blood and torn lips.
"You should have been more careful," said Oberon Glor, stepping forward.
He leaned down to study me, and I gazed back into his haughty, leonine face. Bearded, powerful, commanding.
"He's halfway to death," Oberon said with annoyance. "I told you fools I wanted answers." "Ask me yourself," I gasped.
Lord Oberon raised his eyebrows and stared at me.
"What brought you to my house, Inquisitor?"
"The Pontius," I replied.
It was a gamble, and I wasn't hopeful, but there was always a chance that the very word might auto-slay them, as it had done Saemon Croats in the Sundome on Hubris. As I suspected, it didn't.
"You came from Hubris?"
"I stopped Eichlund's work there."
"It was aborted anyway."
Lord Oberon stepped back from me.
"What is the Pontius?"
I asked, trying and failing to focus my will. The pain in my body was overpowering.
"If you don't know, I'm hardly going to tell you,"
said Oberon Glor. He looked round at Uracel, Locke, and the pipe smoker.
"I don't think he knows anything about the true matter. But I want to be certain. Can you be trusted to work efficiently, Locke?"
Locke nodded. He approached me again, flexing the needle glove, and slid a needle into my head behind my ear. My skull went numb. It became almost impossible to concentrate.
"My index needle is lancing right into your parieto-occipital sulcus,"
Locke crooned in my ear,
"directly influencing your truth center. You cannot lie, no matter what." "What do you know of the true matter?"
"Nothing," I stammered.
He jiggled the needle and pain ignited inside my head.
"What is your name?"
"Gregor Eisenhorn."
"Where are you born?"
"The Kears world."
"Your first sexual conquest?"
"I was 16. A maid in the Skolem."
"Your darkest fear?"
"The man with blank eyes."
I blurted out the last. All were true, all involuntary, but that last one surprised even me. Locke wasn't finished. He jiggled the needle and pierced the back of my neck with others so that my body went into paralysis and ice flowed down my veins.
What do you know of the true matter?
Nothing. Without wanting to, I began to weep with the pain. Gorgon Locke continued to question me for 4 hours, 4 hours that I know about. Beyond those, I recall nothing. I woke again and found myself lying on a cold rock-creaked floor. Lingering pain and fatigue filled every atom of my being. I could barely move. At that time in my life, I had never felt such an extremity of pain and despair. I had never felt so close to death.
"Lie still, Gregor. You're with friends."
That voice.
Amos.
I opened my eyes. Uber Amos, my trusted savant, looked down at me with a soulful expression even his augmetic eyes couldn't hide. He was bruised about the face, and his good robe was torn.
"Lay still, old friend," he urged.
"You know me, Amos," I said,
and slowly sat up. It was quite a task. Various muscle groups refused to work, and I came close to vomiting. I looked around blearily. I was lying on the floor of a circular rock-crete cell. There was a hatch on one side and a cage-gated exit opposite it. Amos was crouched near me, and Elizabeth Beckwin, her gown ripped and dirty, hunched behind him, staring over at me with genuine concern. Away across the cell stood Haldane, arms folded, and behind him cowered the Gilda Machellis and the 4 other Guild Synesius envoys who had escorted us. All of them looked pale and hollow-eyed, as if they had been weeping. There was no sign of Betancourt. Amos saw my look and said,
"Aegis insubstantial, before the deluge,"
in perfect glossier. Which meant Betancourt had somehow avoided the sweep that had incarcerated all my other companions. A tiny fragment of good news. I got up, mainly thanks to my determination and the support of Amos and Beckwin. I was still stripped down to my leggings and boots, and my torso, neck, arms, and head were washed in my own blood and stippled with bruised micropuncture wounds. Gorgon Locke had been thorough. Gorgon Locke would pay.
"What do you know?"
I asked them as my breath returned.
"We're as good as dead," Haldane said frankly. "No wonder my master leaves this kind of work to you, suicidal radicals. I just wish I hadn't agreed to join you."
"Thank you for that, Haldane. Anyone else want to offer something less editorial?" Amos smiled.
"We're in a prison cell under the west wing, to the rear, almost under the woodlands. They burst into our quarters after you'd been gone 3 hours and seized us at gunpoint. I memorized a careful note of the route we were taking to this place, and have mentally compared it with Midas's map, so I'm fairly sure of our location."
"What the hell did they do to you?"
Beckwin asked, dabbing at wounds on my chest with a strip of cloth torn from her gown. Wincing, I realized that that was why her gown was so shredded. She had been mopping my wounds while I was unconscious. A pile of torn and blood-soaked scads of material nearby stood testament to her devotion.
"They came here an hour ago and tossed you in with us. They didn't say anything,"
Haldane added.
"Are you really an Inquisitor, Sire Farchival?"
Machelis asked, stepping forward.
"Yes, I am. My name is Eisenhorn."
Machelis began to sob, and his fellow envoys did the same.
"We are dead. You have taken us to our deaths."
I felt some pity for them. Guild Synesius was rotten to the core, and these men were corrupt, but they were only in this predicament because I had duped them.
"Shut up,"
Haldane told them. He looked round at me and slid a tiny something from the cuff of his body glove, a small red capsule. "What is it?"
"Admylodox, a 10-gram dose. You look like you need it."
"I don't use drugs," I said. He pushed it into my hand.
"Admylodox is a painkiller and a mind-clearer. I don't care if you do drugs or not. I want that in your system, if that gate opens."
I looked at the gate.
"Why? Have you never been to a pit fight?" he said.
The Glaws had got everything out of me they could. Now they wanted me dead. Me and my party. and that meant sport. The gate cranked open at what must have been dawn. Thin, grey light wafted in, and was almost immediately replaced by hard, bright, artificial luminescence. Housecloth militiamen in body armour burst into our cell and drove us out through the gate with force shields and psych whips. We were out in the open, blinking into the light, as the gate shut behind us. I gazed around. A vast circular amphitheatre, enclosed by a dome high above, undoubtedly the golden dome we had seen on our approach. The floor of the pit was dank moss and earth, and lichen climbed the sheer sides of the 10-metre-high stone walls. Above the wall top, House Glor and its guests sat in steep tiers, jeering down at us. I saw Uricel Glor, Lord Oberon, Locke, Lady Fabrina, the Ecclesiarch Datso, the pipe-smoking man. Terence, the militia captain who had sat at our table during dinner, led an honour guard of nearly 40 men of the retinue. All wore green armour, plumed silver helmets, and all carried autoguns. More than 200 baying members of the Glor clan, house staff, militia, and servants, made up the rest of the crowd in the theatre. They'd been up all night, drinking and doing whatever other indulgence it took to turn them into hyperactive, bloodthirsty hyenas by first light. Ignoring the noise, I surveyed the compound. Brakes of trees sprouted at various places, and there were low outcrops of bare rock, giving the arena a sort of landscape. Nearby stood a rack of rusty weapons. Macellis and his brethren had already rushed to it and taken blunt short swords and toothless lances. I went over and took a basket-hilted dagger and an oddly hooked scythe with a serrated inner blade. I weighed them in my hands. Haldane had taken a dagger and a long-hafted axe, Bequin a wicker shield and a stabbing knife. Amos shrugged and took nothing. The jeering and booing welled around us. Then it hushed, and a chorus of gasps whispered from the auditorium. The Carnadon was 6 metres from nose to whipping tail. 900 kilos of muscle, sinew, striped pelt, and sawing tusks. It came out from behind one of the clumps of trees, trailing a line of heavy chain behind it from its spiked collar, accelerated into a pounce, and brought Macellis down. Macellis, envoy of Guild Synesius, screamed as he was destroyed. He screamed and shrieked far longer than seemed possible, given the spurting body parts the Carnadon was ripping away. It must have been my horrified imagination, but to me the screaming only stopped when he was a gnawed ribcage being shaken in the bloody moss by the vast predator. The other envoys screamed and ran. One fainted.
"We're dead,"
Haldane said again, raising his weapons. I swallowed the capsule he had given me. It didn't make me feel much better. Its huge, bared mouth running with blood and its chain jingling, the Carnadon turned on the other envoys. Bequin shrieked. A second Carnadon sprang out of its trap towards us. It was slightly larger than the first, I noticed. It came right for me. I stumbled and dived to my right, and the feline dug its claws into the moss to arrest its pounce, overshooting and scrabbling round. Its trailing chain swished over my head. The creatures both made low, subsonic growls that shuddered in their cavernous throats and thumped the air. The larger beast swung around and made for me again, even as I regained my feet and leapt backwards. Haldane ran in from the side while its attention was on me and hacked into its flank with the blade of his axe. The Carnadon issued a strangulated hiss and lashed around, hurling Volksman across the arena, the clothing of his torso shredded by deep parallel claw marks. I jumped away and got a few of the twisted trees between it and myself. The first Carnadon had brought down another of the envoys. The shock of the impact and the crippling wounds simply silenced the man, and he uttered no sound as his limp body was thrashed and worried. The creatures were hungry. That much was evident from their prominent ribs. One factor in our favour, then. When the Carnadons brought down prey, they were primarily interested in consuming it. The long chains secured them to ground spikes next to their traps and allowed them free movement anywhere in the pit. Clearly the chains were measured carefully to prevent them leaping clear of the pit into the crowd. Tail slashing back and forth, the larger predator circled the edge of the arena bull, its dark, deep-set eyes surveying the humans in range. Bequin had dug herself and Amos into a corner, using her frail shield and a wall buttress as cover for them both, but the ruthless crowd were pelting them with coins and bottles and pieces of food to drive them out. They wanted sport. They wanted blood. The circling Carnadon, barking vapours of breath and spittle from its dripping snout, came round and began to accelerate towards Bequin and Amos. Its pouncing mass alone would kill them, I was certain. I ran out from cover to intercept it side-on, and the crowd whooped and stamped. It faltered in its run-up as it became aware of me rushing it from the flank, and started to turn as I cut in with the scythe. The old hook planed matted fur from its shoulder blade and left a long red scratch down its ribs. It turned hard to face me. A paw lashed out, jabbing. I jumped back, swung again, hoping to at least hit the huge paw, for its reach was far longer than mine. Then it threw itself forward, a throbbing roar welling from its throat. I simply dropped on my back, stealing its chance to knock me down and shatter my bones. Then it was on me and over me, a paw crushing and slicing my chest, its head down, mouth open, reaching to bite off my face. Frantically, I thrust with my weapons, blind, and kicked up at its more vulnerable underside. The weight was off me abruptly. The Carnadon jerked away, making a terrible low moaning. My dagger was no longer in my hand. The pommel was jutting down out of the beast's chin. The blade transfixed its mouth, pinning it closed. It pawed and tore at the weapon, trying to dislodge it, shaking its massive head like a horse bothered by a fly. I got up. Blood ran from the fresh gashes on my chest. Haldane suddenly crossed my field of vision, his shredded tunic fluttering behind him. His axe came down square onto the great carnivore's back, cutting through the backbone with a loud crack. The Carnadon went into spasms, thrashing and clawing, rolling in the dirt. Haldane brought the axe down again and stove in its skull. The audience shook the pit with their howling. Missiles rained down on us. Haldane turned and looked at me with a murderous grin of triumph. Then the huge weight of the other Carnadon hit him from behind and flattened him face down into the arena floor. It had finished with the other envoys, all except the one who had fainted, who still lay where he had fallen. It tore into the helpless Haldane, ripping his scalp, rending the flesh off his back. With a guttural cry, I ran at it, caught it behind the ear with my scythe, and pulled. The curved blade hooked into the meat, and I succeeded in yanking its head back for a second. Then a well-aimed bottle struck me on the side of the head and knocked me over. I lost my grip on the scythe. The creature turned, leaving Haldane a mangled wreck, face down in the bloody soil. I scrambled back, kicking at it. "Eisenhorn!" Bequin yelled, running forward on the other side. She threw her knife over the creature's back, and I caught it neatly. Disturbed by her cry, the beast swung about and lashed at her, tearing the wicker shield into hanks of raffia and knocking her down. I threw myself astride its back and thumped the dagger down repeatedly into its neck. The dagger barely seemed to bite into the thick hide. It writhed, trying to throw me off. I saw the scythe dangling from its scalp behind the ear, grabbed it, and hooked the blade under its spiked collar. The creature was frenzied now, pulling hard at its chain. I pushed the tooth of the dagger in through a link in the chain and down into its shoulder blade, then levered the weapon over with all the force I could muster. The link twisted open. The chain parted. The Carnadon ran forward a few paces, bellowed, and lunged. Effortlessly, it leapt up the side of the pit into the shrieking crowd. I was still attached to it by the scythe, the handle of which I clutched frantically. As we landed in the seating, I was thrown clear and crashed down onto the frantic fleeing audience. The beast was berserk. It tore into the crowd, hurling limp, mangled forms and gouts of blood into the air. The pandemonium shook the dome. I got up, pushing away the individuals who fell and stumbled into me in their efforts to escape. Gunfire ripped out across the amphitheater. In the higher stands, I could see the militia scrambling down, firing at the Carnadon as Terence and other men hustled towards the safety of a side exit. The militia's shots were hitting people in the crowd. I jumped across the backs of several seats and punched aside two servants who grabbed at me. On the steps of the seating tiers just above me, two household guards ran down, raising their autoguns to shoot at the creature loose in the crowd. I felled one with a psychic lance, powered by rage and adrenaline, and snatched his weapon from his hands. Before his companion could turn, I had blown him down the steps and over the rail into the pit with a short burst of gunfire. I looked up at the seating where the Glor nobles and their guests had been. Lord Glor, Locke, and the pipe smoker had already disappeared, and the guards were half carrying Lady Fabrina and the Ecclesiarch away. But Uricel Glor was still there, bellowing at his men over the bloody tumult. He saw me. "The Inquisition will show you no mercy," I yelled at him, though I doubted he could hear. Uricel stared down at me for a moment, then shouted some more oath-laden orders and turned his attention to the Carnadon. It had ploughed beyond the common seating now and was disemboweling a member of the house militia. Multiple bloody gunshot wounds showed in its striped pelt. Uricel snatched a hunting rifle that one of the men fetched for him. He took careful aim at the Carnadon and fired. The massive weapon roared, and the huge bulk of the creature flipped over, its chest blasted open. Its falling bulk crushed the legs of a guard. The crowd continued to flee, but the uproar decreased enough for me to notice that a series of bells had begun to ring, metal bells electrically triggered. From deeper in the vast mansion, other alarms sounded. Uricel lowered his rifle and gestured to some of his men to discover the meaning of the alarm. Those in the crowd not too far intoxicated or mindless with fear looked anxiously around. There were distant, inexplicable sounds. I didn't wonder much about them. Uricel took aim again. At me, this time. I dived over, and a section of wooden seats exploded. I clambered up. Uricel was reloading the wide-bore hunting iron, and Terence was heading down towards me, followed by other men. Terence fired. I aimed high and blew his head and his plumed silver helmet apart with another tight burst. Uricel was about to fire again. He drew the hunting piece to his shoulder and found me in the crowd. There was an abrupt, sizzling series of buzzing shots from somewhere behind me. Three of the militia guards at the pit rail juddered and fell, and Uricel Glor was thrown backwards, his hunting rifle roaring as it fired wildly up into the dome. The crowd began to mob frantically again in a second, and the remaining soldiers swung their aim up, hunting for this new shooter. I swept around and saw him at once, Midas Betancourt, crouched up on the tiled slope of awning above the pit seating on the opposite side of the arena. His needle guns, one clutched in each hand, spat again, peppering the front stands with lethal shots. Members of the household and several more guards tumbled. One guard pitched over the rail and fell into the pit. Further along the front rail, the crowd's panic to get clear of the carnage turned into a stampede. The rail snapped, and half a dozen pages and kitchen staff spilled down the side of the pit wall. One clung to a broken rail end for a second before sliding off and dropping. The remaining guards had found Midas now, and were firing up at the tiled awning with their autoguns. Tile chips exploded out in a haze of dust, but Midas was moving, sure-footed, along the terracotta shelf. Holstering his weapons, he slid down its length, grabbed the edge with both hands, and executed a superb swing that carried him round and under the lip and into the emptying stands. The guards tracked him, firing wildly, cutting down members of the screaming crowd. I ran down to the rail. "Cover! Cover!" I yelled down to Beckwin and Amos below. They were busy trying to drag Haldane's bloody form to the comparative safety of the pit wall. I ran to the nearby body of a guard and grabbed some more magazine clips from his harness. A few shots whipped my way, but most were aimed across the pit at Midas. I took cover behind some seats and some of the Carnadon's victims, and opened fire up at the stands, aiming short bursts at the militia. Return fire chopped my way, and gobbets of wood and flesh sprayed up from my makeshift cover. Midas was moving again, his guns buzzing. The alarms were still ringing. And now, behind them, and the frenzy of the fleeing crowd, I could hear gunfire and the dull rumble of explosions. Most of the arena had emptied now, except for the last handful of house guards trading gunfire across the pit with the stealthy Midas. The sounds of explosive fighting outside in the grounds and house were getting ever louder. I reached the banks of seats where the masters of the house had sat. The Glors and their honored guests were now long gone. Uricel's hunting rifle lay on the ground, and blood flecked the seat. Midas had at least winged him with a needle round. I pushed past the end of the seats and down into the stairwell. The autogun braced at my hip. The bodies of two staff members trampled in the press lay broken there. Uricel Glor had not gone far, bleeding badly from his shoulder wound. He heard me coming and staggered around, firing a small stub pistol down the gloomy tunnel. Then he disappeared from view. Gun butt raised under my arm, I moved forward, searching the darkness of the dank stone tunnel. An opening to the left looked down into a stairwell that entered the cell bay below. To the right was a hatch that allowed access to the main house. I pushed the hatch open with the barrel of the autogun. Uricel came out of the cell bay stairway, howling, and slammed into me from behind. I hit the doorframe face first, and the autogun fired off 3 shots as it twisted out of my grip. Without even trying to turn, I doubled over and reached behind me, grabbing a fold of dress uniform cloth, and jerked Uricel Glor around into the wall. He cried out. I threw a left-handed punch that sent him reeling, then a right that smashed his teeth. He enveloped me in a bear hug, and we stumbled back a few paces before I braced, kicked his legs out, and jabbed a knuckle punch into his sternum. The fight seemed to be out of him. I choked him with a clawing hand and cracked his skull back against the tunnel wall. "There will be no redemption for you, sinner," I spat into his bloody face, "or your foul house. Use your last breaths wisely and unfold your truths to me, or the Inquisition will teach you pain the Gorgon Lock has yet to imagine."
"You,"
he gurgled through blood and spittle and flecks of shattered teeth,
"you cannot even begin to imagine the imperial misery House Glor will wreak. Our power is too great. We will pitch the bastard emperor from his golden throne and make him grovel and feed upon excrement. The worlds of the Imperium will blister and burn before Oberon and Pontius. Exalted will be the great darkness of Slaanesh."
I cared little for his heretical ramblings, but the mention of that demon blasphemy turned my stomach and chilled my heart. I knocked him down and looked around for something with which to bind his wrists. Beyond the tunnel, the House of Glor shook, as if caught in a war zone. Midas Betancourt appeared at the mouth of the tunnel and saw me lashing Uricel Glor to a heating pipe with lengths of awning cord. He holstered his needle pistols and walked down to join me. I heard him activate his vox link and report his position. A curt response crackled back. "What's going on?" I asked him.
"A battlefleet Scarus naval action," he replied smugly.
He'd been out in the dark when Glor's men came to seize Amos, Bequin, and Haldane. I was by then 2 hours overdue, and he'd slipped away from our apartment to look for signs of me. The militia had fanned out through the estate searching for him, but Midas was the sort of man who wouldn't be found if he didn't want it to happen. He had avoided the hunting parties, broke into the house's communication annex, and sent a brief but comprehensive report, in code, directly to Commodus Voke in Dorset. Voke's response had been immediate and authoritarian. The Glor family had forcibly detained a servant of the Imperial Inquisition and his associates. That was all the excuse Voke had needed. His demands, which brooked no refusal, swept clean over the heads of Fleet Admiral Spatian and his officio, and went straight to the Lord Militant Commander himself. The Lord Militant had mobilized a detachment of naval security troopers into Voke's remit within half an hour. As an inquisitor, I know I have the right and authority to demand such supportive responses myself, even from a Lord High Militant, and I have done, on a very few occasions. But I was still impressed by the respect and fear the old inquisitor conjured in men of such supreme rank. A confident move like this was characteristic of Voke, characteristic of his crushing, heavy methods. He'd wanted the slightest reason to come down upon House Glor with the proverbial wrath of Marcharius, and I had given it to him. My capture, at least. Part of me was certain this show of influence and authority was Commodus Voke's way of establishing himself as alpha male, inquisitorially speaking. I didn't care. I was glad of it, in truth. The bloodshed in the arena might have broken us out, but without the assault we'd have never made it out of the Glor estate and the clutches of the militia alive. The operation was coded Pacification 505. 505 being the topographical signifier for House Glor. The troops had run in before dawn in 4 armored dropships, hugging the rolling terrain of the inland bluffs to avoid the more than competent sensor system of House Glor. The ships held off behind the neighbouring hills as the sun rose, about the time we were languishing in the cell, to allow a forward team of naval security troopers to run ahead on foot, and cut holes, electronically, in the perimeter defences of the Great House. By then they were in range of Betancourt's personal vox set, and he had fed them logistic information and an insider's view of the militia's deployment. At approximately the same moment when the first Carnadon had lunged up out of its trap, the dropships had spurred forward from behind a long finger of copse and came powering up the vale towards the house. The Imperial Light Intruder Frigate Defense of Stalinvast, retasked by Admiral Spatian on the Lord Militant's instruction to hold geosynchronous orbit above target Glor 505, had obliterated the launch hangars behind the yard with pinpoint strikes from its lance batteries. Two dropships, rocketing smoke charges and anti-personnel grenades, had settled in front of the main house, blowing out all the windows. 40 black-armored troopers from naval security had then made an assault landing and struck at the main facade. Bewildered, more than 70 men of the house militia had attempted to repel them. The other two dropships circled behind the house and spilled their troops into a landing yard, still lit by the blazing ruins of the launch block. Within 3 minutes, a running gun battle was shuddering down the halls and corridors of House Glor. The alarms were ringing soundly by then. House Glor owned close on 400 fighting men in its retinue, not to mention another 900 staff, many of whom took up weapons. Glor militia were all trained men, veterans, well-armored in green ballistic cloth and silver helmets, well-equipped with autoguns, heavy stubbers and grenades. An army by most standards. I know more than one commander in the Imperial Guard who has taken cities, whole planets indeed, with such a number. And they had the advantage of home soil. They knew the layout, the strengths, the weaknesses of the old estate. Naval security took them apart. The elite of Battlefleet Scarus, armed with matte black hell guns and iron discipline, they conquered and purged the great house room by room. Some pockets of resistance were heavy. The troopers lost 3 men in a virtually point-blank firefight around the kitchen area. A suicide run by 2 Glor soldiers laden with tube charges vaporized another 4 and took 20 meters off the end of the east wing. 22 minutes after the assault began, the militia had lost nearly 300 men. Numerous householders and low-ranking staff fled into the woods and valleys behind the house. A few made good their escape. Most were rounded up, and more than 30 killed by the tightening circle of Imperial Guard cordoning the estate. These men, 2,000 of them, were recruits from the Founding, Gudrunite riflemen roused from the barracks and shipped inland to experience a surprise taste of combat before ever leaving their birth world. The bloody resistance of the Glor militia was mainly intended to give their nobles time to flee. The Glor's off-world cousin and his retinue were cornered by the Gudrunite rifles on the back path behind the house, arrested and then massacred when they tried to fight their way out. Other traders and guests from the dinner surrendered to the enclosing forces. Several orbital craft broke from the tree cover behind the main attack, launching from secret hangars in the woods behind the house. One was hammered out of the air by a trooper with a rocket launcher. Another 2 made it 5 kilometers down the valley before they were incinerated from above by the watchful defense of Stalinvast. Another, a fast and heavily armored model, evaded the cover sweep and headed west. The defense of Stalinvast launched a trio of fighters after it, and they eventually brought it down in the open sea after a lengthy chase. Only weeks of forensic recovery might reveal who had been aboard any of those craft, and there was no guarantee that an answer would be forthcoming even then. Smart money was on the likes of Lord Glor, Lady Fabrina, Gorgone Locke, Datso the Ecclesiarch, and the nameless pipe-smoking man. Certainly none of those persons were among the anguished scum rounded up by the guard or by naval security. 90 minutes after it had begun, Pacification 505 was signalled as achieved by Major Joam Jokels of Naval Security. Only then did the launch carrying Commodus Voke move in.